Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabideau.
Hey, good. This is Peter. The deep voice is a dead giveaway. And, of course, we've been California dreaming quite a lot in recent weeks, and we're going to continue.
Dreaming and drinking.
We're going to continue on that same theme today with, first of all, a highly recommended place to stay on your way.
Absolutely delightful.
And some terrific wineries. There are lots and lots of wineries, of course, in Napa and Sonoma. We caught up with three that we thought were particularly interesting stories. So we're going to bring that to you once you're established in the Napa Valley. Here are some places that you might go.
Now, this Napa River Inn, I hope we convey in this interview that how basically charming it is in the sense of old Napa. On the Menu spent the most delightful evening, brief as it was since we arrived so late in Napa, but we stayed at the Napa River Inn, and here we are about to interview the general manager, Sarah Brooks, about, well, first of all, Rabbit, why don't you tell our listeners, where are we?
Well, we're in a place that a lot of people who visited California have never been to. It's called beautiful downtown Napa. The first of the communities in the Napa Valley, which of course takes its name from the river and the town, which flow through this particular space where we are. But it's a place a lot of people bypass because they really want to get into the wine part of the valley and they want to get out into the country. And as Sarah is going to explain to us a little bit later, there is an experience here that they're really missing that the Napa River Inn offers. But from a geographical standpoint, if you drove here from the San Francisco International Airport, it would take you, as it did us last night, with no traffic, about an hour and 15 minutes. With traffic, it might take you half a lifetime. But when you get here, it's a really delightful establishment that we'll get Sarah to explain how it came into being as a property.
Yeah, how about some history, Sarah?
Over to you, Sarah.
Sure. Now, we might say that Sarah has been here for 10 years of her young life. And so she knows the property as well as anybody. So tell us.
Sure. Well, our building was built in 1884. And it was originally the stop in Napa where the steamships would stop and unload their cargo. And, it was definitely an integral part of downtown. And for a long time, these buildings sat empty when they were no longer used. And Mr. Harry Price bought the building back in the early 1990s. And he was trying to redevelop them. And for quite a while, they were a little bit of an eyesore. They were beautiful buildings, but they sat empty and, you know, they were getting run down. I don't know if you had a chance to look upstairs at all of the historic artifacts that we have. The original punch tin from when this was a society building. We had a skating rink upstairs, an old wooden skating rink.
Yes, I read that.
We have the original hardwood flooring, actually, that was up there from.
Was that in the room where we stayed?
It was, yes.
I noticed that. It was so absolutely magnificent. And rich, you just don't get that kind of craftsmanship now.
Well, tried as much as possible to keep the original building materials that was here. You know, we try and cherish the history that we have, and it is beautiful, and there's not a lot of places that you can go anymore and really get a feel for that. And there's definitely, you know, not a lot of places in the Napa Valley that have hung on to those. There's been so many beautiful buildings that have been torn down, but I think people are really recognizing that fact and restoring the old buildings, and downtown Napa is a great example of that. They've got several buildings that people are remodeling, and you know,
now this is sort of part of a complex, right?
Well, this is the Napa River Inn is part of the historic Napa Mill, which almost all the buildings that we have are historic, except for two of the new guest room buildings. We have four restaurants, we have a jazz club, we have a bakery, Vintage Sweet Shop, which makes homemade candy. They've been around forever. We have La Pelle Skin Spa, which is our new spa opening next week.
There are a lot of spas in this town.
Well, you know, people come here to relax, so I think that there's definitely a need for those spas. And in downtown, there's quite a few day spas. There's probably, you know, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe 10 or 12 day spas in downtown,
yeah,
because not only are they used by the tourists, but also locals. You know, we all like to relax a little bit now and again too.
Now, who comes here now, Sarah? What kind of traveler?
Well, I think that our market really is people who are coming for a nightlife. If you want to come and stay in downtown Napa, we have a great location right on Main Street. You can walk everywhere. There's now, I believe, 22 wine tasting rooms in downtown. We have several world-class restaurants. We have the Oxbow Public Market. There's just, you can come and you can stay at the hotel and walk everywhere. You never have to get back in your car, which is always a concern. You know, people right. don't want to have to not only worry about, you know, having some wine and driving, but also finding your way around. And it's just something that a lot of people don't want to have to deal with. And then if you do want to hop back in your car and go wine tasting, you know, they're 5 minutes from us.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right on the edge of everything happening.
So instead of there being a bucolic setting in a vineyard where they roll up the sidewalk, when the sun goes down, you can have an urban experience.
Exactly.
But you can be pampered in exactly the same way.
Right. And the big thing for our mill right now is that we have some businesses here that are a nice mixture. You can have a great lunch, you can have a great dinner, you can just pop on over to the jazz club and see award-winning performers. We have some fun stuff, we have some very classic jazz, we have cabaret. So that's been a real popular place in downtown for
What's
locals
it called?
And tourists. It's called Silo's Jazz Club.
Yeah, I saw that. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand everything going on. They said they match wine with music.
Yeah, their tagline is pairing great wine with great music.
Yeah.
They have a wine tasting bar in there, and we serve only Napa Valley wines, and everything we serve is available by the glass. So you can get a glass of Opus 1, but you can get a glass of pretty much we have a huge variety, and as long as they're in the Napa Valley, you know, we'll usually carry it.
Now, we experience what it's like to be pampered as well. This is not just a bed and breakfast. This is just a great deal more than that. Tell us what you're looking for in terms of the guest experience.
Well, I mean, we were greeted warmly. Everybody knew we were coming, even though we arrived after midnight. We had chocolates in our room. We had lavender sachets on our bed, luxury linens. Mm-hmm. I think the point... I'm Peter Jack.
Oh, you mean I didn't make my point clear, so you're having to explain it. That's perfectly fine.
This is a place that has
showers for two.
Okay, here's what I'm
saying. It has beds with umpteen million pillows. There's a lot going on here, Sarah.
You know,
the 10 years you've been thinking about this, you've been thinking about what kind of guest experience you wanted to create. Now,
well,
come on, tell
me. Always qualify this charming experience with the fact I really draw the line of plumbing. I want modern conveniences, and you've managed to integrate that, right?
Well, you know, I think that is one good point to make is while the building's been here for over a century, all of our guest amenities are top of the line. They're brand new. While we tried to tie in as many of those historic elements as I was talking about, you know, a lot of our rooms have flat screen TVs. We have premium coffee makers.
Right.
In-room safes, you know, things like that. So yes, we have spent the last 9 years really working to make sure that we've paid attention to every little detail. And our staff is just fabulous. I mean, I don't think that we could have a better staff ever. And they really try to make sure that everyone's greeted when they come in. And really feels like they can ask for anything. Because I think sometimes some hotels, you're afraid to approach or you're afraid to ask if you need something because you don't feel like they're willing or ready to help you. And there's definitely none of that here. I mean, you can go to any of the businesses here and you wouldn't get that feeling.
Or you know they're going to charge you for it.
For example,
Peter this morning got documents that he needs to look at between now and tomorrow, which, of course, he has no way of printing. So I asked the desk, like I said, if I put these documents on a jump drive, can you print them for me? She said, of course.
No question.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
So sad to relate, I have my homework for tomorrow, but I was able to get it. But nobody said, go to the business center, and you go to the business center, and you find it's 25 cents a page.
Right, yeah. Right.
That's not what's going on here. This is people who are thoughtful about what the hospitality experience is like.
Well, and I think, you know, we like to tell people that we really are such a great value. We're not as high priced as some of the hotels in the area. We're also not the least expensive, but what's included in that we think is really an experience that people leave here happy with and want to do over and over again. Complimentary wireless. We deliver breakfast to the room, which is always included in
wonderful.
The room, right?
Yeah.
And Sweetie Pies is such a favorite of everyone's. I can't tell you how many compliments we get on the breakfast. And that's just, I think, one of the unique touches that we add. I mean, where can you go and get breakfast delivered to your room that's included in your room rate? Usually that's an arm and a leg to have that done.
And how about website? Do you have a website?
Oh, we do. Yeah, that's www.napariverinn.com. And then there's also a website for the Historic Napa Mill, which is the complex website, and that's historicnapamill.com.
Now, we should put in a quick plug for the place we had lunch today, which is the Napa General Store.
The Napa General Store.
Oh, that was wonderful. Yeah.
Did you sit outside?
Yes.
We did. It's absolutely glorious. You've done a lovely job in creating a flower-surrounded space with some sort of quirky artifacts there that sort of make you feel
right
at home.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this incredible mosaic.
Well, the fountain is just absolutely gorgeous. And,
you call it the fountain.
It's the mosaic fountain. Okay. And that was actually done by a local artist here named Alan Shep. And it's just beautiful. We have people come from all over to take a look at that fountain. And outside dining on the river, you just can't beat that. On so many nice days here in the Napa Valley, that a unique experience to be able to sit out there along the river walk and dine. And not only does the General Store have that, but also Angèle Restaurant, which is our French bistro right on the corner right there.
Okay. Well, we missed that, but we're going to catch up with Celadon.
And around the corner to the other side is a restaurant where we're going to have dinner tonight called Celadon. Greg.
Cole.
He's the owner. He also has another restaurant in town, I believe, as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's Cole's Chop House, which is a fabulous steakhouse.
But we are going to be bringing you an interview with the chef at Celadon, which we'll record shortly, I think. We've been surprised and delighted to know that you could stop so quickly upon entering the Napa Valley and be able to enjoy urban experience. But an urban experience is pretty peaceful. I think we only have one warning we should add. If you're coming back to the Napa River in around the same time as we were, which is 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, allow some extra time because that route 29. Well, describe
it. I'll make you a map of the back ways. I'll show you the way the locals go.
I should have been smart enough to know that the Silverado Trail would have been much quicker.
And that really just depends on the day. You hit right during when everybody's getting off work and everyone's heading down valley, and you're going to hit that no matter where you are. We don't have a lot of traffic in the Napa Valley. It's just that it's all funneled into two places. So typically, if you're going the back way down Silverado Trail or on the side crossover streets, you don't have too much of a problem.
Yeah. Well, you're delightful, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thanks for staying with us. We enjoy having you.
Now, we love the hospitality.
Before we jump off, is there a general site for the city of Napa too? Because we found out only after we got here that there was a farmer's market this morning, but by the time we found out about it, it was going to close within 20 minutes. Is there a place where people can go to find out about events like that?
You can go to the Arts Council Napa Valley website, which has a calendar of events for all of Napa Valley. It is the greatest resource. And I'm sorry, I don't recall the name of the site offhand, but just repeat the name if you would. It's Arts Council Napa Valley. Okay. And I believe it's artscouncilnv.org. If you Google it, it'll come right up. And not only do we have the farmer's market 2 days a week, we have chef's market coming up. Chef's market during the summer is so much fun. It's nights, it's Thursday nights. And here at the mill, we do locals night on Wednesdays, and that's from 5 to 7, where we display local artists along the river walk. Uh-huh. And out back on the plaza, there's different discounts that are offered, you know, throughout. And if you're a guest of the Napa River Inn, you can take advantage of those local discounts, so you can kind of pretend that you're a local that night.
Great. Well, that sounds terrific, and we'll post that correct website.
Oh, great.
We'll check it out and make sure it's on there for people to be able to take advantage of it.
And actually, I completely forgot about this. Just this week, we launched our new website, which includes the Arts Council calendar. So if you go to napariverinn.com, you can click on calendar of events. It's the exact same calendar.
So there we got that.
Yeah, there you go. That's easy enough.
Sarah, well, thank you so much for your hospitality. It was fun to be here. We congratulate you, and we understand that you're probably going to stay for quite a while. So
I sure hope so. I like it here.
Guess coming over the years. The secret that we didn't mention is that Sarah was born and raised in Napa and never saw a reason to move away.
That's true, and hopefully I never do.
So no, when you come, ask for Sarah.
Yep, absolutely. I'm always around.
Okay, well, we'll be following this with an interview about Celadon, where we're going to have dinner tonight. But once again, Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoy your dinner.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And as we said, we just rolled right into dinner and interviewed the chef at Celadon. As promised, on the menu is having dinner at Celadon, one of the most well-established and much favored restaurants in Napa proper. The chef owner is Greg Cole, and his chef de cuisine, because Greg has two restaurants, he also has Cole, which is a chop house, Cole's Chop House and Steakhouse, but Marcus Uribe, who's from Mexico City, is the chef de cuisine. He's been here about you've been here running this restaurant for 6 years. Six and a half years. But you've worked for 10 years. You've worked with Greg.
With Greg, yes.
Okay, and we have said to you before. How did you get from Mexico City? This guy's so laid back. How did you get from Mexico City to Napa, California? And you said,
well, one of my friends invited me to come over, and I was a little bit tired of being in Mexico, so I took a nice adventure and ended up here in Napa Valley.
Now, Peter has a good description of how you ended up in your position in this restaurant. He says you're a yes man. Now, Peter describes you, Marcus, as a yes man. You decided to come here. You started washing dinner. Our dishes, rather, excuse me, and they said, can you do this cooking task? And Marcus says, yes, I can, and he did. And so then the next stage comes on, and they say, can you move up to this station and do this and cook this? And you said, yes, I can, and so you did that. And then they say, can you do breakfast? Yes. Can you run this restaurant? Yes. And so here you are.
Yep, that's what it got me here. And also the passion about cooking. As soon as I walked into a kitchen, I was, like, impressed of everything. So it kind of was like, oh, I felt like I was there before, and I just start moving on.
Now, you don't cook. You do some Mexican dishes here, but you described the Celadon menu for us as providing global comfort food. What does that mean?
Well, we're not based on just one type of cuisine, like American, French, or Italian, and I've been working in a few restaurants here in Napa. I've been doing American, classic American food, a little bit of Asian fusion, French. So we try to put everything together into one place, and it's here at Celadon, where you can find all different kinds of spices, different dishes. You use Mexican spices, you can use Japanese spices, French techniques. You can use everything. You know, it's just whatever is available and fresh here in Napa as well.
Well, now, you're going to do a tasting menu for us. I have this dinner menu. Could you just describe some of these dishes that we're going to have?
Well, you're going to have a nice soy-braised crispy pork belly. It's on a watermelon salad. It has a little bit of rice wine vinegar, mint, basil, cilantro, a little bit of salt, pepper, just the nice herbs that go pretty well with the braised pork belly, and finish with a little bit of sweet soy sauce. This is Indonesian soy sauce.
It sounds great. What else?
We're also going to do just a little bit of our famous flash-fried calamari with the spicy chipotle glaze, a little bit of pickled ginger.
I love calamari, yeah.
And people say it's one of the best right here in Napa. Well, wait until you try it and you'll decide. We're also going to try a little bit of the baby spinach salad with a duck confit, a little bit of date, petit basse cheese, and a truffle vinaigrette. So that's one of the very, very good salad that I made here at Celadon.
Yeah, that's your recipe, right?
Yeah, that's one of my recipes.
I imagine a lot of these dishes are yours now. They're on this menu, huh?
Yes. I've been creating dishes here at Celadon for 6.5 years.
That's great. Well, I mean, I'm really excited about trying it. What else should people know about this restaurant? You have a great wine list.
We got great the ambience. We got a full bar and very friendly, down-to-earth kind of restaurant.
Yeah, and we're outside, and it's covered, and there are ceiling fans. There's a fireplace in the center of the room, and there are paintings on the wall against the rough brick. It's absolutely delightful and charming. So, anyhow, I'm looking forward to a lot of fun.
All right, yeah. Well, I'm going to get back to the kitchen and try to get some food out here for you.
Oh, thank you for talking to us, Marcus.
No, thank you.
Okay, let's have fun.
Okay.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
welcome back to On the Menu. Do email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com or chime in on our blog, which is onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Or do what it is Anne prefers you to do, which is the Twitter.
Tweet at me.
At OTM Dish. And Facebook, I'm not sure who she is on
Anne
Facebook.
Haig.
She's Anne Haig on Facebook. That's
oh,
a surprise.
No space, right?
No spaces. Okay. So, lots
well,
and lots
why don't
of...
you introduce the next thing? Because this
oh, okay.
is one of your favorites coming
well,
up
well,
here.
Well, wine's one of my favorite things, and I guess I get to do quite a lot of the preparation for that. And one of the fine old names, one of the real founders of the wine industry in Napa, is a wonderful vineyard called Duckhorn. So we went there and we had a lovely chat with a young man from halfway across the other side of the world who happens to be making wines at Duckhorn. Duckhorn's a very well-known name in the California wine business. A lot of people think because a duck on a pond is the symbol that must have something to do with it, but it turns out, like Mr. Arrowwood, Mr. Duckhorn had an unusual last name, but it certainly seems to fit into the California wine world. We're at his property today in just off the Silverado Trail, like about 100 yards off the Silverado Trail in Northern California, talking to Bill Nancaro, who is the winemaker for Duckhorn, and he's standing in for the boss to tell us about how Duckhorn got started and what it meant to the beginnings of winemaking in California.
Yeah, well, Dan and Margaret, they started the company back in 1976. That's when they bought this 10-acre property, which was actually used to be a vine nurse business. And Dan's background prior to that was in finance. And one of the companies that he worked for actually had an interest in the vine nursery business, and the opportunity came for them to actually purchase this. Dan's actually from Northern California. Margaret is from the Midwest, and then they met and both went to Cal Berkeley. And they went on a trip. They were both fascinated with wine in the early 70s, and they went on a trip to Bordeaux, and I think specifically to Pomerol, with Rick Foreman, because one of the formative winemakers here in Napa Valley, particularly his tenure at Sterling. And they fell in love with Merlot, the Pomerol wines, and a few of them from St. Emilion as well. And they came back to Napa and they thought, this is something that we can do here. And
so they were in love with Merlot from the beginning.
Yeah, they were totally intrigued with it. And they thought that Napa, California, Napa specifically, could make a wine worthy to be compared to the great wines of Pomerol and St. Emilion. So, and there was no one doing it here at the time.
The interesting thing, Ian, is when you go to Jordan, it turns out that Tom Jordan, who founded Jordan, was fascinated by the wines of the Bordeaux region. So he set about making Cabernet Sauvignon-based Bordeaux wines at Jordan, and he's still doing that today.
Yeah, I guess maybe he spent a little bit more time on the left bank, and Margaret and Dan spent some more time on the right bank.
And he just became fascinated with it and said, we can make a wine like that, and I have enough money that I can go pursue this dream of doing the same thing. So it's fascinating, and Merlot is still a big Duckhorn thing.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what people, I think, they regard us as being one of the premium Merlot producers out of California, and we're very fortunate in that regard. But, I think the interesting thing was if you talk about the Jordans and the Winarskis down at Stag's Leap and Robert Mondavi, those people who started their businesses and their wineries in the late 60s and early 70s, and I think Cabernet Sauvignon, because if you go to Bordeaux, those first growths that were more Cabernet dominant were the true hierarchy wines in the world. And I think that's what really inspired them. Dan and Margaret kind of went the other way because the Merlots, the Pomerols, Petrus and Le Pin and Cheval Blanc, maybe didn't have as much credence in those days as they do now. I think that Merlot wave really took off through the 80s. But I think they took a bit of a gamble in trying to make a varietal Merlot here in Napa Valley. And we're very fortunate that their first vintage, 1978, was a fantastic growing season, a fantastic vintage, and we got fruit from an amazing vineyard, and we still do today, the Three Palms vineyard. And also they stumbled across a fantastic winemaker, Tom Rinaldi, who is the winemaker here for 20 years, and Tom has an absolute talent with Merlot, and he really established our style.
Now, people, listeners, you'll have detected that Ian Nancaro doesn't have an accent from Northern California, from a different place. And he's now the winemaker here in the tradition of the gentleman he just mentioned. So there's a sort of a special version of your story that you told us before we came on air, but I think listeners will be interested in it.
Yeah, well, obviously I'm from south of the border. I originate from New Zealand, and I've been a bit of a global globetrotter, I suppose. Spent some time in South Africa and then started my winemaking career initially in your sort of backyard in England. And then went back to New Zealand, and that's when I really fell in love with making the Bordeaux varieties and Merlot in particular. And then found an opportunity to come over and work with Duckhorn, and there was a synergy with the Merlot thing there. And I've been here for 6.5 years now.
And have you been the winemaker the whole that time? No.
I've been with Duckhorn for 6.5 years, and we have two other wineries other than Duckhorn Vineyards.
Okay.
Golden Eye, which is a breed of duck, and that's our Pinot Noir facility in the Anderson Valley. And then Paradux, a pair of ducks on the label, is 15 minutes down the Silverado
right,
Trail here in Napa.
Right, today.
Right. So I initially came over as the Paradux winemaker and developed that winery. And then 2.5 years ago, moved back here to Duckhorn and oversee winemaking in the Napa Valley.
Now, did you go through a formal enology program, or did you just learn on the job?
No, I've just learned on the job. You know, my background is hotel management and running restaurants and a bit of cooking, and just learned on the job. I drink a lot.
I asked Clive Coates once. You must know Clive Coates. I said, how come you know so much about wine, Clive? And he said, I guess I must have just drunk a lot of it.
Yeah, it's amazing what if you just indulge and if you commit to try and remember things about every wine that you've had, and even if you write down notes, it's amazing your recall, and you learn things.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, you think you have a special tasting skill?
I don't think I have a unique palate. I think anyone can learn.
But you have a pretty good one.
I have a fairly acute. I have weaknesses, and I'm very aware of those, and I think that's a strength, the fact that I am aware of them. And then within my winemaking team, you know, we've got people where their strengths are my weaknesses, and so we work very well together.
Yeah, on the menu, listeners, we'll remember recently we interviewed Aldo Sohm, who's the sommelier at La Bernarda in New York and was the best sommelier in the world in 2008 and would be again in 2009 if he was allowed to enter the competition, I'm sure. And we asked him, when did you know that you had something special? To be able to distinguish between wines and really understand them, but mostly to be able to pick one from another and as a result be able to help people. And he said, I don't know when it happened, and my memory isn't perfect, but I guess must be fairly good at it.
Yeah, that must be good. And it's interesting, you know, they people now talk about the super tasters.
Right.
And, you know, these are people, I guess, they have a few more taste buds on their tongue and they're able to pick up a few more flavors and compounds than us normal folk.
So you wouldn't consider yourself a super taster?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No, you know, I have bad days where I can't taste a thing.
Oh, why?
And maybe it's because I've been tasting too much the prior day.
Yeah,
you get palate fatigue.
Well, interestingly enough, a lot of women are considered to have a larger percentage of super tasters than men. And the last time we were here in Napa, we talked to Eileen Crane, who you know at Domaine Canaris. And there seems to be an increase in the number of women in winemaking. Is that your observation as well?
Absolutely. And I think it's fantastic. And I would agree that females do tend to have a more acute taste perception and trained, and my mentor still, Kate Radburn, back in New Zealand, has a fantastic palate, and I learned so much from her. And yet when she was describing a wine, you know, there were things she was picking up on it that I still to this day can't. And
is that right? So she had a perception of elements of the taste that you couldn't even spot.
Yep, absolutely. So I really conform.
Now you believe that. You believed that those really existed. They were not just wine reviewers' words.
No.
Sometimes wine reviewers' words seem a little extreme.
They do. Yeah, I think that sometimes they get a little superfluous. They
swallowed a little part of
swallowed
a little part of the dictionary with all the adjectives in it.
Yeah, and I struggle with that. I mean, we try to keep it fairly basic here because I think you scare people off. If you get a little bit too carried away with some of the descriptions.
Yeah, I agree. At the core of it, how would you describe the good Duckhorn Merlot to someone who's trying to understand whether they'll like the taste profile?
Well, if you're talking about our Merlots in particular.
Yes, I mean, what words would you use to describe them?
Okay, well, you know, we make 4 to 5 different Merlots each year. So, and they're all different stylistically for different reasons. So, you know, we could go through the full gambit. But our Merlots, and this, all of our red wines, in fact, here at Duckhorn, are structured wines. So they have true varietal characteristics. So our Merlots have plumminess in terms of a fruit profile. They have some spice notes to it. But they also have structure. They have a tannin profile. They have a dry extract. They're made so they need to be aged, and they benefit from aging as well. So it's not it's not a light-hearted Merlot, and I think Merlot's got a bit of a bad rap in the last few years.
It has.
And there's been a lot of ordinary Merlot made throughout the years in California, and as people rode the wave of its popularity, got planted and made in some locations where perhaps it shouldn't. But our Merlots have always been big, and a lot of people describe our Merlots as being more Cabernet-like. And I guess that's probably how I would describe them in general.
And that would be considered a compliment by most people.
I think so. Yeah, a lot of people are surprised by the strength of our Merlots.
I mean, people are thinking about wines in terms of richness. The king of the hill, with some notable exceptions like some of the Super Tuscans, Cabernet Sauvignon is at the top of most people's heap, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I, here in Napa Valley, hands down, Cabernet Sauvignon, I think, is the king here in Napa Valley.
Now, you make wines of that grape too, right?
We do. Yeah, we make four or five Cabernet Sauvignons each year as well. And we blend. You know, we very seldom make a 100% varietal wine. Our Merlots have Cabernet in them. Our Cabernet Sauvignons have Merlot, and we also use Cabernet Franc and Petit Verdot as blending options as well.
Now, Bill Nancaro, he knows this question's coming up because I previewed it to him. So, listeners, it's not like I'm asking him a really hard question that he didn't know without giving him a chance to prepare. But you're a young man looking to the future. What do you see in the future of Napa that our listeners might find insightful, since you live here all the time?
Well, I think obviously there's a lot of wineries here and a lot of winemakers, and I think you'll find winemakers are very inquisitive people and we're always intrigued to try new things. So I think there's a few small projects where people are looking at other varieties that perhaps haven't been grown or haven't been successful in the past in Napa.
Like?
Well, I think, you know, Syrah is still trying to find its footing here in Napa Valley, if not all of the entire California, and there's some very good Syrah's being made. Very small production, pretty hard to find, but there's some great examples of Syrah being made here in Napa. Whites are very interesting. We've really only got the two staples, and that would be Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc, but I think a few people looking into Viognier. Been some very interesting examples of Viognier coming out of Napa. Mm-hmm. And I think that'll continue as those vines gain some age, get settled into their environment a little bit more. So I think a few guys have tried Sangiovese, hasn't really worked, but maybe it needs to be in a different location. There seems to be a very small cult following for Petit Syrah. There seems to be a few more Cabernet Franc producers popping up every year. So not non-traditional grapes, but perhaps things that have fallen by the wayside and they're coming back.
Things that haven't been successful in California.
Yeah.
We might be finding more of those out there.
Yeah, I think what I hope for, you know, even as a producer, is I hope going forward, I hope a lot of our Napa wines can become a little bit more accessible and a little bit more affordable as well. And I think Napa is definitely one of the greatest places in California, for sure, to grow fantastic red grapes and very good Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay as well. But I think it'd be nice if we could maybe bring our cost of production down a little bit and make the wines a little bit more accessible.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Bill. It's been a whole lot of fun. You've been on an interesting life's journey already. I hope your life's journey continues and that you continue to enjoy it as you obviously have until now. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. You know, I'm having a great time here, and I forget that I have an accent, and really, really enjoy it here in Napa Valley. It's a wonderful place, that's for sure.
Thank you so much.
And from Duckhorn in Napa Valley, part of the history there, to Matanzas Creek in a section of Sonoma that we'll learn more about, we found another non-American in charge of winemaking, a wonderful, charming Frenchman at the fine old winery called Matanzas Creek. On the Menu is really out in the country today. In fact, we're so far underneath a beautiful mountain in Northern California that internet access and cell phone reception is a major problem. But we came here to visit with a fascinating winery called Matanzas Creek, and we have the unusual pleasure of talking to Alex Reble. Looks like Rebel, but it's really Reble, and that's because Alex is French.
Yes.
Which is somewhat unusual for a winemaker in Northern California, we think. So first up, Alex, tell us how you got here. What was your life journey that got you to this wonderful part of California?
So first of all, Anne and Peter, welcome to Matanzas Creek in Bennett Valley. Yes, unusual to be French in a wine business, maybe, but in a world wine business, it's of course not unusual, because I started my career, I'm from Bordeaux, I was raised and I grew up in Bordeaux. I worked at different estates, I graduated over there. I worked in the Médoc area, in the Grave, and as well in Pomerol, at Petrus, for example, one of the well-known Pomerol producers. And I was able, after that, through different relation, to make my way through through California. I did work a little bit in Oregon, and I'm here in California for the past now 10 years, and happily at Matanzas since 2001 now.
That's amazing. So you feel like a permanent fixture almost.
I am. I'm hoping to have many more years of happy winemaking in Bennett Valley. Yes,
that's right. Well, Matanzas Creek is really a dramatically situated vineyard, yes, and winery. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, actually, Bennett Valley is a recent appellation. We are lucky that our owner, Jess Jackson, was able to bring to the eyes of the world that beautiful little valley here in this part of the Sonoma County. This is an appellation that is very recent, since 2003. And so it also has a lot of characteristic that are unusual in the wine business. That French word terroir that everybody should know. You know, I always try to explain terroir as taking the image of a puzzle. You know, I'm a winemaker here in Bennett Valley, and I play with my own little puzzle. I have, you know, rootstock, I have varietal, I have weather, I have all sorts of little pieces that I have to deal with every day. And if I'm a winemaker in New Zealand, I also play puzzle, but I have also my little own pieces, you know, that I have to deal with. And so.
Sure, so it's a different puzzle altogether.
Yeah, it's a different puzzle. We all play the same game, but with different little pieces like that.
Yeah, because this thing called terroir is different.
Absolutely.
And I loved your definition of it. It's exactly my definition, because it's not just dirt, which terroir sounds like.
Yeah.
It's all the other factors that you mentioned. Now, you mentioned that Bennett Valley became an appellation, but Matanzas Creek was here long before that.
Absolutely. The groundbreaking of Matanzas was, late 70s, I think 78, 79, started. And, there is some great story about that very beginning. The owners at the time hired a well-known, winemaker that was actually doing the wine, Mary Edwards, who was the first winemaker here. She was making the wine down below here at the property in an old dairy farm. And so, many of those beginning wine and Matanzas were done over there. And actually, we will taste, the Chardonnay, and there is an interesting story about that. Being in a dairy farm, she actually went through malolactic in the wines without doing any addition like that. And so that was kind of a process that was unusual. And so after checking, with the local lab analysis, she found out that we had our own strain of malolactic bacteria. And now it's actually sold worldwide as MCW, Matanzas Creek Winery.
Oh, that's amazing. So Chardonnay was one of the first things produced here?
Yes, I think Matanzas was always very well known for beautiful crafted wine, and Chardonnay and Merlot as well, and Sauvignon Blanc were always, the top, winner in the Matanzas portfolio. Yes.
Now, 06 Chardonnay is what we're sampling this morning.
That is correct, yes.
Tell me a couple of things about that you think make it particularly appealing.
Well, Matanzas, as I was explaining the word terroir earlier, Matanzas is all about respecting what Mother Nature is giving us. And you will see that all those wines are very fruit-friendly, because when I'm respecting my terroir, I'm also sourcing my grapes from this terroir. If you talk to a chef, my wife works at the Culinary Institute. My dad used to be a chef, so I really into food as well. And if you talk to a lot of chefs, they like good ingredients. You know, don't ask a chef to cook a bad piece of meat or something like that. So if you think about it that way, you want to respect where your grapes are coming from, and that's exactly what we are all about. And that's the very reason why our wine goes so well with food, because, you express the minerality of the soil, you express the fruit-forward character that you get from the vineyard, and that really a great match for a lot of food that we have around here.
Now, there are some people who criticize California wines for being the opposite of fruit-friendly, because they're over-oaked and they're over-extracted and they're too hot in terms of alcohol content. So I'm thinking to myself, well, Alex is going to say that doesn't apply to Matanzas Creek wines.
Well, like I said, we are following Mother Nature, so sometimes we do end up with an alcohol that could be a little lower. For example, the Chardonnay is right around 14%, which is a decent amount, but all the other ones that we have on the table, the Sauvignon Blanc, I believe, is 13.5. So it's actually closer to things that I'm used to in Europe. You know, we have lower alcohol. And you have to be honest, you know, a good wine is a wine that is drunk, you know, by your customer. And a lower alcohol actually invite people, you know, to have, you know, maybe more than one glass, you know, which is okay.
But you're also managing the use of oak as well.
That's right. So, on, you know, if you look at you know, the profile of those wines, we don't go over a quarter of new oak in every single wine. And the reason why would you like to mask, you know, whatever the terroir is giving you by addition of oak, which is, of course, you know, a natural product, but we feel like we have enough texture, enough balance, enough flavor in our wine that we don't need to add anything else. That's our position.
Now, you talked about Chardonnay as the first. Now, there's another white here, Sauvignon Blanc. Is that a newer entry into the Matanzas Creek portfolio?
There was Sauvignon Blanc from you know, the very beginning, but it's really something that we developed. Actually, the only little difference in the Sauvignon Blanc is that we get it through our vineyard up in Knights Valley. And so the Sauvignon Blanc is actually a blend. It's Sauvignon, but also we had his very close cousin, the Sauvignon Musqué. And the reason is that because we love the acidity. We love the acidity of the Sauvignon Blanc, but we do add a little bit of Musqué because it's a great way to fill the meat palate and have a good balance with the acidity of that the Sauvignon Blanc is.
Now, that's a grape, I must confess, that's a grape I never heard of.
Well, it's a very close, you know, biologically, it's a very close cousin.
Now, a lot of people blend Sauvignon Blanc with Semillon, so you're doing something similar, but with this other grape.
Yeah, we are actually, in 2009, you know, we are actually in the works of coming up with some new blends. We do have some plantation of Sauvignon Blanc that are very, very young, so we're going to have to wait a little bit. But yes, you're right, a Bordeaux style wine does have a little bit of Semillon in there. But for us, we feel like Sauvignon and Sauvignon Musqué are just a match, you know, a great match right now.
Alex, this is a very interesting wine. What food, since you always have food in mind, what would you pair with this?
Well, you have a Sauvignon Blanc that is not, you know, over-oaked. There is a little bit of oak aging. But really what you have is a crisp wine, a fruit-forward wine with a lot of, you know, bright melon and watermelon type of aromas that you may find. So something, you know, that, you know, I heard recently somebody who had a great experience with some Thai food. You can as well, you know, the obvious will be with a lot of seafood dish, you know, with a nice grilled fish will be a perfect match, I believe.
Now, in my mind, and in the mind of an old friend of mine, Dr. Raymond Neff, who's a person that Anne knows very well, we spent a lot of time drinking wine as well as working together, and he adored your Merlot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Matanzas Creek is probably best known in the wine world for Merlot.
That is correct, yes. One of the names that often come back when I visit some key market, you know, in Chicago, I was in Chicago not long time ago, is the Journée. You know, we used to make a Journée here. But Merlot by itself has always been one of the key components, you know, of what Matanzas is known for. Merlot has also went through a different process. As I was saying, you know, Mother Nature, we cannot trick Mother Nature, you know. It takes time to develop a vineyard, it takes time to grow vine, and it takes time to mature your fruit. And so our vineyard that we are sourcing the grapes from Jackson Park, which is right across the street here, has been planted a little over 10 years ago. And I think now it's really the time where the vineyard is really giving us a top quality fruit, and of course for hopefully many years to come. But this is almost a single vineyard. You know, we are sourcing the Merlot from a 100 acres ranch, and that's the only Merlot that we are getting here at the winery. So and we are sourcing the Merlot from 35 different blocks. So you can see I was talking about puzzle. Here you go. I'm coming back to my idea about puzzle.
You know? You must have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, you know, I have two kids, so I have to play something at home, you know, and so puzzle is my favorite game. Yes.
but it's quite a palette with 35 different lots to play with.
And, you know, with François Cordes, the winemaker, we are often in a vineyard, and he believes that there is at least 6 or 7 type of soil even on this single 100-acre vineyard. So if you, I don't know how good you are in math, but if you multiply 6 by 35, here you go. You have so many different amount of little pieces that you have to put together. And so that's our challenge and our pleasure every day. Yes.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing for On the Menu listeners. You can listen out for this one. We talked to another winemaker on this trip, and we asked him about blending, and we said, do you taste immediately after you blend? And he said, I do, and sometimes I'm horrified about what I did because somehow it doesn't matter how I blend. Right afterwards, it really never tastes right, and I have to wait till the next time I taste to make sure I did it properly.
That's right. You know, François and I, we are tasting, for example, coming back to the Chardonnay, we are tasting every single barrel, because when you do a fermentation in barrel, every single barrel acts differently. So you may have a barrel that is done with malolactic fermentation, and maybe another one who is actually not done yet. So you're going to have, even within the same block, some different characters, different tastes. So, but in general, yes, you're right. When we do a racking, we usually add oxygen to the wine. And so if you taste the wine right before it's being racked, it's going to be a different animal, and you never know. And that's one of the beauty of our job, absolutely.
Now, we couldn't be in California at a vineyard without some production of Cabernet Sauvignon, for which California is best known. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about Matanzas Creek in that space.
Yeah, we are doing a little bit of Cabernet, which we don't have today, but the Cabernet is actually a little bit, we are using it as a part of a blend, because we believe that a wine is best served as being a blend. And we had a little bit of Cabernet. Soon we will have a little bit of Cab Franc. So we try to go back to some kind of a Bordeaux style blend. But the Cabernet is coming back from Knights Valley as well, which is a great area right along the slope of Mont Saint Helena. And it's one of the very good components as well in our portfolio. Yes.
Now you couldn't fail, of course, to want to deal with the fickle Pinot Noir.
Well, Pinot Noir is kind of a new arrival for us. Matanzas was, of course, not known for Pinot Noir. But you have to deal with that as taking a step back and looking at what your terroir is telling you. You have cool climate. Remember that we are next to the coast. So it's a simple physics matter. You know, warm air goes up along the side of the mountains and basically draw cool air from the ocean right behind. So we have what we call the Petaluma wind gap that's come from the San Pablo Bay down in Carneros area. And so we have a very cool region here. And if you look at all the great world vineyard in, you know, even in France, when you talk about Pinot Noir in Burgundy, they all have the same characteristic. They have like little hills or little mountain along the side with a cool climate. So Bennett Valley, even if Pinot Noir was never really something that Matanzas had done in the past, we started to plan that because we believe this is a great area with, you know, maintaining a good acidity in a varietal like Merlot, Chardonnay, and why not Pinot Noir?
So you've got a terroir that's a little bit similar to the Russian River and that area,
yes,
which is better known in Northern California.
Actually, it's nice that you talk about the Russian River, because in average, we are picking 5 or 6 days after Russian River. So they just tell you, and Russian River is usually a vineyard that is picked, you know, one of the latest vineyards that is being picked in Sonoma, and we are actually way behind that. So just to tell you, you know, how much of a cooler climate we are compared to our neighbors.
I get the impression that you're something of an enthusiast for Matanzas Creek, and you're sort of here for the duration.
Well, you have to be enthusiastic because, you know, there is a lot of great job in the world, but that's one that you have to use all your senses every day. And, you know, I don't mind doing that, and I enjoy doing that. So, it's absolutely.
Alex Reblay, was a delight to talk to you. Now, Anne has a question.
I was just a comment on the fact that he is so eloquent, that you speak so well about your wines. And, of course, your wines speak very well to the quality of your ingredients, your puzzle pieces.
I've been told that I need to work on it every day, so that's what I'm doing. So.
Well, the accent goes well, and your boss, Francois, possibly is French too.
Yes, he is, yeah. I believe he is, yes.
I think we should all be grateful for the contribution that you're making to California winemaking, and thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Peter. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And now we'll take a break for a little advertising.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, rolling into our last segment, and this one I'm particularly interested in. I love the fact that this new winemaker is coming up with some all kinds of interesting directions, new directions, and also that he does yoga.
And his winery also happens to be biodynamic, which is a big thing that we've talked about before as well. So Eller's estate, just north of St. Helena or St. Helena, I'm never exactly sure which way it's pronounced. You'll find this wonderful winery right by the side of the road, but a very, very carefully run property, producing some excellent wines, and you can expect even better with Kevin Morrissey with a background of years at Stag's Leap, now at the helm, and not really telling us exactly what he's going to do, but it's certainly going to be a man to watch. So there we were, all set to insert a wonderful interview that we had with Kevin Morrissey, the new winemaker at Eller's Estate, and Peter has to admit with shame, he can't find the file. So just so that you will have the story of Eller's Estate, we're going to include in here a recording that was included in a previous program, which will tell you about this wonderful property. And we'll make sure that we catch up with Kevin another time, and we'll bring him to you.
Kelly McElerney is calling On the Menu Radio from California with an interesting story, a story that has a whole series of dimensions. But we're featuring the story in the run-up to Valentine's Day for a special reason. Kelly, why don't you just explain that?
Well, I think what makes us sort of unique as far as the Valentine celebration, our company, the winery located in the Napa Valley, is held in trust by a medical foundation that devotes all of its research to cardiovascular. So therefore, everything that we produce and sell, our net income, goes to support their mission.
So this is called Have a Heart, Give a Heart, but it's really in spades, huh?
It is. I think we're one of the places where you can actually say drinking our wine is good, not only for your heart, but for many other people's hearts as well.
Now, we should quickly say, of course, that the flagship wines are all red.
Yes.
With all the good things that go along with that. What are they called? Polyphenols or something?
And reversitol.
Reversitol. Okay, there you go. So there's lots of reversitol, and we got a really nice shipment to try, and I was just telling Kelly just a few moments ago before we came on the air that we drank all of them except one,
that was disciplined as it is.
And that's the 1886 Cabernet Sauvignon, and there's something very special about 1886. Kelly, why don't you tell us that part of the story?
Certainly. Well, and you may recall also when you were looking at the bottle, it's a unique mold. It's a beautiful old world style. We were trying to tie together the history of our property, which starts with the date, 1886. And there was a German gentleman that came from Sacramento area to buy the land from the local Episcopal minister. And if you have a moment to visit our website, you will see the original building, which was constructed in 1886 by Bernard Ehlers, is the building that we still operate out of today.
Now, why don't we, while you're mentioning the website, why don't you just spell it out for us?
It's EllersEstate.com, and that's EllersEstate.com. And we're a beautiful little parcel, about 40 acres, located just north of the town of St. Helena. And we do all of our farming. We're certified organic growers. We also employ biodynamic farming practices. But what really makes the property special, as I mentioned earlier, it's one of the few remaining properties intact from the late 1800s. The people that were running the winery during Prohibition, two local brothers, the Dominguez brothers, were able to bootleg. And so many of us that still have buildings that are in a good state of repair were able to keep the property because of our predecessor's ability to bootleg.
Well, we'll whisper that word, huh?
Yes. Well, we celebrated the repeal of Prohibition this last December, 75 years.
Oh, that's amazing! Isn't that amazing? I never did quite understand what drove that original constitutional amendment through. But there's a bar in Washington, Pennsylvania, not far from where we live, called the 21st Amendment, which obviously celebrates the same thing.
That's a clever, catchy name for a bar. That's great.
I'm sure it's not the only one that's out there.
Probably not, but you have more history on the East Coast than we do out here. So.
Now there's an interesting multinational flavor. Because the original founder was German, Monsieur Le Duc, who bought the winery, I forget what year, you told me a moment ago and I've forgotten.
Starting in the 80s, correct.
In the 1980s.
Correct, 19, sorry, yes.
And he was undoubtedly French.
Yes, he was. And then you've got, as we were again talking, we've got our Italian winemaker, Massimo Di Costanzo. So we do have a lot of Europe going on here.
But how would you characterize the Ehlers Estate wines?
We really aspire to be known for our site-specific or terroir-driven wines. And back to that one wine that you mentioned, if I could walk through our portfolio quickly.
Please do.
Okay, so the 1886 is really the pinnacle offering that is most expressive of that site-specific winemaking style. And we have focused on a couple of different blocks within our 40 acres. We have a soil series that is at the base of the Mayacamas Range. We're on the valley floor, yet we are really quite close to the western hillside. And that soil series is called Perkins, which is sort of a highly touted soil series that's found in the Oakville region. And then we have on the backside of the parcel a small knoll with some elevation gain. And that soil series is Aiken, which is primarily found on the Howell Mountain Appalachian. So we source most of the cab for the 1886 from these two blocks, and it's definitely a wine stylistically that can be enjoyed in its youth, but as you indicated, it will definitely benefit from some cellar aging as well.
Now it's definitely a premium market wine. Are there a couple of wines that are perhaps slightly better known that you would say it's sort of like this?
I would think sure. Spotswood comes to mind immediately because these again are wines that are highly representative of the terroir and the site specific wine growing. That we believe we do just as well. And I would also put into that camp some of the Duckhorn cabs that are estate designated and vineyard designated. I would put into that camp Araujo, for example.
You've pictured it just perfectly for me, and I think any California fan will be familiar with these other names and will be able to associate and say, now I know which part of my cellar it belongs in.
Well, we hope that we eventually can be just touted on that list.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that's true, but I have to admit, I mean, I think I know my California wines fairly well, and Ehlers Estate was not on my radar screen. I had not heard of it. That doesn't mean that you did a bad job or that I did a bad job. It's just that there's a name that needs to be made here, and I hope we're helping with that. And the unusual aspect of the Le Duc, if you like, the legacy,
right?
Which is that the entire property is run for the benefit of research into cardiovascular disease is really a terribly important thing to happen, because it really is the national killer of the largest quantity of Americans and the largest quantity of people in many other countries around the world. So the association with red wine and the good resveratrol that it has in it is a great thing. But going beyond that and saying, I'm going to make the biggest contribution that I can to dealing with this heart disease problem. You're certainly putting your money where your mouth is, as my mother would say.
Yeah, we're very pleased. And I do want to be quick to point out, though, that the foundation really is funding amazing research on the university level. So, ironically, the fact that they have a winery in their portfolio, that isn't even the type of research that they engage in. So they're really looking towards genetic predisposition for heart disease and what they can do to reverse that and actually alter the outcome of people that may sort of come into the game at a little bit of a deficit for whatever gene pool that they inherited. So it's really profound, the research that they engage in.
Now, we, of course, we quickly consumed the other bottles in the shipment that you sent, but go over those for us as well, if you would, please.
So again, the property is about 40 acres, and it is comprised of Bordeaux varietals. We grow mostly Cabernet, about 20 acres is devoted to that, but then we produce a varietal Merlot, which always has a bit of Cabernet and Cabernet Franc blended back in. And it's more, we position it as a Cab Lover's Merlot. I think, unfortunately, Merlot has taken kind of a beating over the last few years. But if you are a consumer that likes a really fruit-forward, rich, some nice oak elements framing the center core of the fruit, our Merlot is something to be considered. It's not a light aperitif style Merlot. You really can pair it with food. It's got a nice acidity profile. So it's a fine Merlot for many different occasions. We also produce, which is quite fun for us, a Cabernet Franc. And that has been traditionally 100% Cabernet Franc used from the excess on the blending from the Merlot and the Cab. And it's also just a very different style. It's not quite as green as many people might imagine a Cabernet Franc could be. We're in a very warm growing area, so it has sort of a spicier element, quite frankly. A little bit of a white pepper, and there's also a floral component on the aroma that is distinctive and, again, not necessarily what you would expect from a Cabernet Franc.
It's like the denser varieties of the red wines from the Loire, where Cabernet Franc, of course, is the red grape that's used.
Right.
So it's a little bit like a Sambuca Champigny or a Chignon or something like that.
Correct. I think, though, because, again, of our warm growing climate, we actually do taste every other Friday here at the winery, and we did do tasting of Chignon, and it was very fun to see the similarities, but also some significant differences between just the growing regions are so different.
Sure, I'm just trying to give people who would pass Cabernet Franc from California by, give them a hook to hang it on that says, among the wines you will have tasted and probably enjoyed, here's something that's very similar. In fact, I can recall having a wine from Anjou, from the Angevin region, which fooled everybody in our blind tasting pool.
Okay.
with the strength of the wine, and no one imagined it could possibly be from the Loire Valley. It surely had to be from the southwest somewhere.
Oh, that's so fun to do that in a tasting, too.
Now, are you up to anything new? Are you doing more of the same, or do you have some new wine adventures for people who are following your wines?
Well, the one thing that we do, which is also very fun, we have a wine club, and we devote every year a blend, it's a Bordeaux blend, to a wine club offering that's exclusive to that group. And what I think is really great is the name of the wine is, and let's hope that everybody can kind of see the tie-in on this, the wine's called 120 over 80.
I got the message.
You got the message. So we have our offering this year, and it is, as I mentioned, a Bordeaux blend. So for us, the fun part about this particular product, it's something that you shouldn't be too analytical over. It's something that is really to remind us that wine should be enjoyed on a daily basis. It should be enjoyed with food and friends and family and around the table. And so we don't want people to take this wine from an academic perspective, but really just feel good about opening it and sharing it on your daily table.
Well, it'd be a good wine to have for Valentine's Day as well, I guess.
It is, but I you know, shudder to mention it too much because it is an exclusive offering through the club.
Okay, so you have to go to Ayla's Estate and you have to sign up.
You do. You can do that through our website as well. But if you're looking for a good wine for Valentine's Day for the local market availability, I would definitely seek out the Merlot. And then as a gift, as I said, the bottle for the 1886 is just a stunning package, and the wine itself is quite extraordinary. So it's fun.
Well, Kelly, I really appreciate your joining us. Again, listeners, this is a special Valentine's Day message for the one you love, who is perhaps long enough along in years that heart disease might be an issue, or they're genetically predisposed to it, or you just want to do a good thing and enjoy giving something through the foundation, cardiovascular research, because it just seems like the right thing to do.
Thank you. Could not have said it better.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining us, and you're on our list for a visit the next time we come to California, which will certainly be before the year is out.
We look forward to it. It's a beautiful property, so we much welcome your visit.
Well, thank you to the LeDuc Foundation and to Ayla's Estates. Once again, Kelly, thank you for the information, and I certainly enjoyed talking to you.
You as well. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Bye.
And I think it wraps.
It does. We'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.